This is the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm David Brancaccio. Let's do Marketplace's Econ Extra Credit, where we revisit basic economics on a weekly basis. We're reading a free Econ 101 textbook, a chapter a week here. This week, it's all about rules and laws that keep our economic interactions from being so winner-take-all. Sounds dry to you? Well, not when the pirates show up. Turns out 18th century pirates, the same murderous, larcenous folks who used stolen ships to steal, used fussy little employment contracts to describe the duties and rights of everyone aboard. Peter Leeson is a professor of economics and law at George Mason University. He wrote a book about the hidden economics of pirates. Hi there.
Pleasure to be here.
I mean, one would think those thieves of the high seas, pirates, would be loosey-goosey when it came to managing their pirate ships. But what? You found there was democracy of a sort and contract law that would often apply?
Not just that. I'd say, if anything, pirates were a bit puritanical. And the seeming puzzle there is resolved once you consider the fact that since pirates were criminals and they were living and working on these ships for months at a time at sea, they needed to figure out some way to cooperate, to get together, to make sure they wouldn't steal from each other or kill one another. I mean, remember, these are people who had devoted themselves to theft and violence as a way of living. So it was perhaps more important for these individuals than even ordinary ones, if you want to think about it that way, to have some rules in place that would make sure that they wouldn't, their raucousness wouldn't cause implosion internally for the crew. And that's what led to some of those more puritanical rules, such as not drinking on the pirate deck after dark and not smoking on certain parts of the ship, not because pirates were concerned with the imagined effects of secondhand smoke, but because there were flammable and explosive parts of the ship that it was important not to have anyone smoking in it unless they were going to be blown to smithereens. Those sorts of things, there was no gambling that was allowed on pirate ships. They were there to prevent the kinds of conflicts that were likely to tear the crew apart.
So not just honor among thieves, but written down actual rules that would guide things. Things like how the spoils of attacking another ship would be apportioned among the crew?
Yeah, so these pirate articles, as they were called. They were first and foremost employment contracts. So all members of the crew got together and they unanimously agreed to these things. And one of the most important things that they wanted to get down first was what the compensation would look like for each pirate crew member. And that compensation typically took the form of a share of whatever the crew plundered.
And I saw one example of these. It was remarkably egalitarian. I mean, yeah, the captain got two shares of any plunder and his, you know, management team got 1.5 shares, but then everybody else got one share. That's not much of a gap between rich and poor.
It's not too much. I mean, there is, you know, it's double. But the reason for that isn't so much that pirates were inherently egalitarian. On the contrary, I think they were pretty much disinterested in that. But rather, this having this kind of flat pay scale was driven by simple concern for making as much money as possible. And the way in which a pretty flat pay scale did that was it made sure that all members of the pirate crew had a similar interest in continuing, or if they were going to shut it down, shutting down the expedition. Because again, if you had guys, if let's say one pirate, you know, earned 100 times more than another, and the crew took some prize, well, that guy might want to call it quits there. But the crew wouldn't last. It had to function collectively as a team. And so they had this flat pay structure to sort of put everybody on the same page.
Okay, so it's sort of like one of those companies where they encourage widespread stock ownership.
That's right. It was a kind of workers' cooperative of sorts. It made sense for them to all be these equity stakeholders in these small floating firms because there were no external financiers. The crew members stole the ship, so they actually jointly owned it. Contrast that with, you know, a firm like Walmart. You couldn't possibly run that thing in a reasonable way as a workers' cooperative because you have external capital that's required. And so it makes sense to give those control rights, so to speak, to the capitalists, to the guys who have the skin in the game. Doesn't mean that the employees aren't playing a crucial role. Of course they are. But in terms of directing the capital and in terms of making the strategic decisions for the firm, you know, we pass, rightfully so, those those rights onto those who have the best incentives to use them.
And you draw a contrast in the book. You know, they have these 18th century pirates, those ships, but there's also the regular merchant, the commercial ships. Those do have absentee owners, and those are run very differently.
Yes, not just differently, but almost oppositely. You know, because back to that kind of Walmart example, although merchant ships were an extreme case of this, because the enterprise confronted what, you know, economists call a principal agent problem. So you have these wealthy landlubbers, these capitalists who finance merchant ships, which were, you know, just ships engaged in international trade. But the wealthy landlubbers don't know how to actually sail. So they have to hire sailors to operate the ships. And the problem is that when the sailors have the ship at sea, they could abscond with the cargo. They could abscond with the ship. They could shirk, not take care of the ship. They could sleep all day. Lots of things they could do that would ultimately undermine the financial interest of the guy who, or the guys who were funding the operation. And so the solution to this problem was for the merchant ship owners to appoint autocratic leaders, if you will, within the merchant ship, which was the guy called the captain, who had all of the authority that the merchant ship owners would have had endowed in their hands to basically watch over the sailors and to keep them in line. Unfortunately, for many merchant sailors, that meant a not very pleasant life at sea.
Yeah, and you weren't contributing your opinion on modifications to working rules aboard the ship in that situation. You were told what you had to do.
That's exactly right. It was still voluntary, so you knew going into a merchant shipping enterprise, you know, there was also a labor contract there between the merchant ship owner and the sailors. But that contract did not include the workers' right to have a say, essentially, in anything that was happening on the ship. Whereas pirates' employment contract between each other explicitly put a provision in that said, all the important decisions of the crew are going to be made by a popular vote. And, you know, that was an enormous difference in terms of the liberty that was therefore enjoyed by pirates versus merchant sailors.
Peter Leeson is a professor of economics and law at George Mason University. He's written articles about this in places like the Journal of Political Economy. But if you really want to go deep, do not miss Dr. Leeson's book about the hidden economics of pirates. It's called The Invisible Hook. Professor, thank you.
Thank you.